As the world anticipates the summit between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea, we hear from Korean Americans here in Illinois about their hopes for what may be achieved. Also, two Illinois natives are hoping to become the first to complete the 320-mile Rock River Trail by bike.
So we're in Teresa, even in the rain. You know what? Many explorers had to do things in the rain. Like, Lewis and Clark couldn't just go back to, like, Virginia just because it rained. Although I'm sure they wanted to.
Later this hour, we'll be checking in with them on the road in Wisconsin. But first, do you know kids who are getting ready to head off to college this fall? Chances are they aren't staying in state.
Illinois has actually been the second largest net exporter of students since the 1970s.
That's State Senator Chapin Rose. He and his colleague from the other side of the aisle, State Senator Pat McGuire, join us to talk about putting a stopper in the brain drain. That's all coming up this hour in the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's lots going on in the world and right here in Illinois today. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking to some of Illinois' Korean American population about what they hope will come from the historic meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. And we'll be hearing from two Illinois natives who are hoping to become the first to be awarded for biking the 320-mile Rock River Trail. But first, many seniors across the state have been celebrating their graduation from high school and are spending the summer preparing to leave for college. But more and more, they're leaving for someplace out of state. Since 2000, the number of Illinois residents enrolled as freshmen at colleges outside the state has increased by 73%. That means almost half of high school grads choose an out-of-state option, leaving our 12 public universities with shrinking enrollment. This is an issue we've talked about before on the 21st, but now it's one that's receiving bipartisan attention in Springfield, thanks to my next two guests, Senator Chapin Rose of the 51st District in Central Illinois and Senator Pat McGuire of the 43rd District in Will County, just southwest of Chicago, are both on the line with me. Senators, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla.
Morning.
Good morning. Senator Rose, let me start with you. Both you and Senator McGuire have been part of a bipartisan working group to tackle this so-called brain drain over the past year. The result was reform to the monetary award program in the state. What were you able to change?
Yeah, well, there was several bills, actually, not just related to the monetary award program, but the two cornerstones. First of all, I think our group did a good service, and we kicked all the university presidents out and brought in the admissions directors. And we listened to every admissions director from every public university in the state. And we said, what do you need to be successful? What do you need to keep kids in Illinois? And we heard two things. One is that the existing MAP program is only good for a year. The out-of-state competition is coming in with four-year awards. And, you know, from a certainty perspective, from a, you know, an affordability perspective, there's no question in a student's mind or a parent's mind that they'd rather go with certainty rather than a maybe. So that was the first thing. The second thing we heard was that there really is no merit-based program in Illinois for our best and our brightest. And so on both fronts, we were getting beat to the door and beat at the door, at the door by the competition. And so the two bills we have was to take the existing MAP program and transform it into a one-year program, into a four-year priority, so that students and their families can have certainty and address the affordability issue. And the second piece is the institutional match program that is it's a new variant of MAP, but it requires institutions to match the state level of support, and it's aimed at keeping kids from leaving Illinois, and it's aimed at exactly that brain drain you just referenced. And so the new institutional match program, we think, will be able to keep about 6,000 kids in Illinois who would have otherwise left. And again, very much address the affordability issue in the same vein. And but, you know, this wasn't me. This was a group effort, and our good leader, Senator McGuire, is on the line, and so we might want to ask him his thoughts.
Yeah, Senator McGuire, just to follow up with what Senator Rose was saying first, just let me ask you about that MAP funding. Is that now guaranteed funding for the next 4 years?
It's prioritized, and Senator Rose did a good job of explaining what he called the cornerstones of the half dozen bills that the higher ed working group put forth in this just concluded legislative session. So again, as Senator Rose said, we don't want MAP to be one and done. We need to We need to send a message of certainty to students and their families. So under the status quo, a student got mapped his or her first year of school, but then it was a roll of the dice whether or not he or she would get it in successive years. So again, the bill that we passed, House Bill 5020, I think it is, prioritizes the renewal of MAP grants. So student gets it year one, has a leg up on getting it year two, year three, year four.
It sounds, though, like Senator McGuire, that's not necessarily on parity with getting it for 4 years in a row. Is that still what students might be competing with from other surrounding states?
I'm sorry, say that again. What about parity?
Well, it sounded like, and Senator Rose, maybe you can jump in here as well. It sounded like one of the things you were hearing from admissions counselors was that students were choosing to go out of state in part because they were getting guaranteed four-year funding, the sort of a MAP equivalent that they knew they would have for 4 years. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, remember, yeah. MAP is need-based. Oh, go ahead, Jason.
No, you hit the nail on the head. This gives them a priority within the program. And so what we learned was that 93% of MAP awardees were coming back a second year anyway. But at the recruitment door, they were only told they could get a one-year deal. And so by giving them priority preference, that gives them the certainty they need to help our recruiters. And in fact, if you look at the early results that have come in from admissions directors around the state, they are absolutely ecstatic with this change to a four-year award.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Senator McGuire.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So Senator Rose mentioned that we heard from admissions directors and financial aid officers from all of our public university campuses. We also heard from leaders in from our community colleges and from our private nonprofit institutions. And we learned that there are two groups of students who have been disappearing from Illinois campuses. One of those who are going out of state. You know, there's been a lot of publicity about students from the Chicago suburbs going to the University of Alabama. Well, that's merit-based aid. Alabama doesn't have a need-based aid program. Illinois has one of the largest and most successful in the country. That is MAP, the Monetary Award Program. And the other group of students disappearing from Illinois campuses are those students who might have middling ACT scores, and they gain admission to an Illinois public university, but they don't enroll there. In fact, they don't enroll at any institutions of higher ed in the state of Illinois. And three of our public university leaders told us our biggest competitor is nowhere. So the four-year MAP is intended to help benefit that group, that lower-income group who have the initiative and the grades to get into an Illinois public university, but then, again, in the fall, they don't enroll at the public university to which they've been admitted, nor do they enroll to a community college or anywhere else. And then the AIM High, the institutional match, which Senator Rose mentioned, is intended to help those students who are going out of state. So four-year MAP has a relatively low income cap on it, essentially, whereas the AIM High program will assist students from families, for instance, a family of four with an annual income of up to $150,000.
And Senator McGuire, Senator Rose was telling us what he gleaned from all of the different folks that you all talked to with this bipartisan work that you all did. What were your big takeaways from not just public universities, but as you said, community colleges and other institutions? Is it that there are students here who can't afford to go to college who aren't?
Yes, we certainly learned that. And we learned that the decline in Illinois higher ed, which predated the budget impasse, that's shaken people's confidence in our Illinois higher education system. And so, we need to convey certainty and predictability. I mean, you know, these are households, especially consider a household in which this son or daughter is a first-generation college student. They may be unfamiliar with navigating the college admissions and financial aid process. So the more clarity, the more certainty we can give those folks, the better off Illinois is going to be.
We're speaking with Senator Pat McGuire. He's a Democrat from Crest Hill. Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet. Both of them on the line with us talking about the work they've been doing. Senator Rose, to Senator McGuire's point about stability, I wonder how much of this work that you all are doing now is, frankly, trying to undo the damage of the budget impasse over the past 2 years and the instability that particularly higher public universities have been facing.
Well, here's an interesting piece of this. People tend to focus on the last 2 years, but the fact is the state of Illinois lost 50,000 students in higher education classrooms, whether they're two-year community colleges or four-year institutions, in the 30 years leading up to the budget debacle. Okay, so we lost 50,000 students before the budget debacle ever happened. And so there's much bigger long-term trend lines here. And certainly the budget debacle was not helpful to any of that. But what I would point out is that during the same time period that the state was losing 50,000 students, we went on a construction spree, increasing capacity all over the entire higher educational infrastructure. Now, you know, four-year community colleges came sort of into their own during that time period. You went from 9 4-year publics and 4 2-year upper division publics to 13 four-year publics, okay? During the same time, you had online offerings that came into the marketplace. And so at the same time, Illinois is losing a massive amount of students over several decades. The higher education, you know, as an entity in Illinois, went on a building spree and just completely overbuilt capacity to what was a shrinking demand. But, you know, I would actually argue that this is more about addressing long-term trends than it is about what certainly was a very unhelpful couple years in the budget debacle. But that trend line started well before the budget debacle. And let me just say this to you, too. If you look at – I pulled up a couple quotes here from folks that are at various institutions. Illinois State University's enrollment management director said that the four-year MAP program, it's crucial to know what to expect and how to budget for all 4 years. This will be a big selling point for students to come to Illinois schools. Again, those are my words. That's from ISU. Eastern's director agreed, saying that this is a much more attractive option. And that trickles all the way down to the community college level. Community colleges and even our not-for-profit private schools were very supportive of this effort at the end of the day because they realize that this is a very long-term trend and it's not a positive trend in the state of Illinois.
Senator Rose, go ahead, Senator McGuire.
Oh, thank you. Senator Rose mentioned community colleges. Illinois has a larger community college network than most other states and also a larger private, not-for-profit sector than most other states. That is, a greater percentage of Illinois collegians are in community colleges and are in private nonprofits than in most other states. So in the reform measures that the bipartisan bicameral higher education working group advanced, we paid attention to community colleges and we tried to be practical. So we passed a bill that would require community colleges to provide transfer advising to students. We passed a bill that would require four-year institutions to effect a reverse transfer degree. So say a student leaves a community college for 30 hours, matriculates to one of our four-year publics, and while at the four-year public university satisfies the requirements to get the community college degree, he or she will receive the community college degree while at the four-year public university. That's important because not everybody graduates from a four-year, you know, life intervenes. And so if indeed a student has to stop out, as the academics say, from his or her four-year university, that student will have an associate's degree from a community college.
Senator McGuire, can I ask you, as you all are talking about this bill, about the cooperation here, as both of you have mentioned several times, the bipartisan nature of this, you're a Democrat, Senator Rose is obviously a Republican. What was the cooperation like with this working group, Senator McGuire?
It's the best I've seen in 6 years. In the 6 years I've been in the state Senate, you know, it's not often in life that one enjoys every minute of a task, but we met 17 times. Some of those meetings were two a days during the final weeks of the session as we guided these bills to passage. And there were 12 of us, 6 Dems, 6 Republicans, 6 House members, 6 Senate members. And we had a common cause to assist Illinois higher education in getting back on its feet.
Senator Rose?
Yeah, this was a true pleasure to work with my colleagues across the aisle. And the great thing, I would actually argue, this started during the budget impasse, in a sense, because at one point in time there was bridge budget, I think is what it was called at the time, in the middle of the impasse, and that bridge budget was actually negotiated after the higher ed schools had said, hey, enough's enough, and their representatives and senators had gone off in a room and basically come up with a budget for higher education, and that then sort of kick-started everybody else to get involved to come up with the bridge budget. And so one of the true, one of the truisms in the General Assembly is that the higher education community is a very bipartisan, very positive group that really wants to do the right thing without partisanship and rancor. And that doesn't mean that you don't have disagreements from time to time. It just means that those disagreements are based on legitimate policy views as opposed to any sort of partisanship. And so I actually see, as I saw before in the middle of the budget debacle, I saw higher ed bringing people together. And so this was just sort of an extension of that.
Really quickly, we're almost out of time. These haven't yet been signed by the governor, all of these bills that you guys have been talking about. Senator Rose, any sense from the governor's office if and when these will be signed?
Well, I think they have to get to them first. There's a time period process by which this all has to go through to actually reach his desk. But I don't think there's going to be any issue once they reach his desk. And I also say that I think it's been such a positive experience. Again, I give lots of credit to Senator McGuire for being our sort of leader, our leader of the group. But I think, you know, we're all committed to continue to do more through the summer and fall on this topic, because certainly, those trend lines are multi-decades long, and it's going to take a multi-decade long response to reverse course.
Sounds like it. Thanks to Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet, Senator Pat McGuire, a Democrat from Crest Hill. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've been following the news this weekend or this morning, you've been hearing analysis about President Trump's lack of diplomacy following the G7 summit in Quebec and what that means for his next trip and historic meeting that starts this evening in Singapore. We wanted to check in with Korean Americans who are living across Illinois to hear how they're feeling about the big summit. But first, we wanted to make sure we were up to speed with what's on the agenda. And Carl Friedhoff is here to help us do that on the line with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, where he is a fellow. Carl, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
So, Carl, before we get to Singapore, I think we have to start in Quebec, or perhaps more accurately, the tweets that President Trump sent from Air Force One from Quebec on the way to Singapore. How would you summarize that and what happened at the G7 meeting?
Well, obviously, the G7 ended in acrimony, and I have to confess I actually don't pay that much attention to the president's tweets, and I think I'm not quite alone in that. There's been some polling out there that, you know, that while the media makes a big deal out of these tweets, not a lot of people are actually reading them. Of course, they do have an effect, especially when it comes to North Korea. He talks about, you know, in the past, he's talked about things like fire and fury. He's talked about, you know, that he has a bigger nuclear button than Kim Jong-un, and that his actually works, and that North Korea responds to that. This is a game that North Korea plays well. It's often, you know, very active in the international media and in trying to shape how people are going to view it and shape the negotiating ground. And so they have been very active on that front.
And I guess I'm wondering if what happened at the G7 summit has any effect on this next upcoming meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un.
I don't think it's going to have that much effect. The messaging has been more directly back and forth between North Korea and the United States. I think the bigger impact was probably, most people are thinking, what happened with Iran, the fact that the United States has pulled out of that nuclear deal. I'm not sure that I agree that it's going to have that big of an effect, and in fact, may play into the hands of the United States and North Korea negotiating rather than hampering those negotiations may make them more optimistic for the fact that North Korea has always viewed itself as special. It's always viewed itself as a bit of an outlier in the international community. And now President Trump is coming saying, look, you couldn't trust other presidents to do any of these deals because eventually, you know, they would get underwritten. But I'm the master negotiator, and any deal that I make is going to stick because of that. And so I think there's now a better opportunity here for something to actually get done. That's not saying that it will get done, but at least the opportunity is there.
For those of us who haven't been following this timeline and events very closely here, can you remind us how historic this meeting is, who's going to be involved, and what's at stake?
Sure. So as far as the participants, obviously, the leaders of both countries, and then they've released long lists of people on both sides from you know, the Secretary of State, the people from the National Security Council, but actually not a lot of State Department officials are on this, and that's because primarily this has been handled by the CIA. And, you know, when now Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was director of the CIA, he went to Pyongyang secretly, and no one even really found out about it. And I think that's one of the big revelations here, is just how quietly this has all been done. Of course, what is at stake is, quite frankly, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I don't think that is likely to happen. North Korea has really pinned its hopes and security on these nuclear weapons, but now it's looking to perhaps sell some of them for international aid. If that does not happen, let's say everything goes perfectly and there's some kind of big strategic decision by North Korea that it is time to give up those weapons again, I think that's unlikely. Then we would see aid flow into North Korea, and North Korea would become quite rich in a very short period of time, given the fact that it's surrounded by South Korea, China, Russia, and Japan. So there would be no shortage of money. So that's on one end, where these things work out really well, and suddenly there's, you know, peace in Northeast Asia. On the other end of that spectrum is that things go really badly. Trump walks out of this meeting, and then we're right back to what he would hope, what the President Trump would hope, is a revival of maximum pressure. Other allies and China have already backed off of that, and I think it's unlikely that we're going to see a revival of maximum pressure in that way. But if that happens and these talks break down and go poorly, we could be very seriously looking at the potential for military conflict. We were quite close to that, it seems, not that long ago, 7-8 months ago. And if talks don't go well, we're going to see the rhetoric ramp up, and that is a very scary prospect in that region.
I'm speaking with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs fellow, Carl Friedhoff. Carl, you mentioned military conflict, and I'm sure there are listeners who remember the Korean War, who perhaps fought in it. And as we're hearing news about the summit in North Korea, we're hearing news about the summit specifically in North Korea generally every day. I wonder what the historical context of history plays into the political landscape today, how much we need to be thinking about our relationship with the peninsula going back almost three quarters of a century, the Korean War, all of this other history.
So you know, the U.S. kind of got involved in all of this right after World War II, where suddenly it became clear that the Japanese were going to surrender or at least going to be defeated. Russia and the United States both rushed into the Korean Peninsula and essentially divided it at the 38th parallel. You know, they drew that line on a map without really understanding anything of the region or the context. And that since that day, it's been divided. Of course, there was the Korean War. That ebbed and flowed with first North Korea almost pushing the United States and its allies off of the peninsula. And then the opposite happened, where North Korea or the United States advanced all the way to the Yalu River and was thinking of going into China, and then China intervened. And then for the next 2 years, 1952, 1953, essentially they battled right along the same demarcation line that was drawn in 1945. And that hasn't changed since. You know, following that, the U.S. has continued to have a troop presence there. It's now originally in the mid-1950s, it was about 75,000. It's now been drawn down to 28,500 and perhaps could go lower in the near future. And, you know, when we look at the U.S. alliance structure in East Asia, it's all what we call a hub-and-spoke system. It's not like NATO, where everyone is part of one group. Here it's hub-and-spoke, where we have an alliance with South Korea, we have an alliance with Japan, but they do not have an alliance with one another. And that's done partly by design, because, you know, for reasons probably too broad to get into here. But if this summit goes quite well, there is a chance that we're going to see a breakdown in that alliance structure, and this is something that everyone is fearing, the fact that President Trump is going to go into this meeting with Kim Jong-un, and he has said before that he's considering pulling troops, not a drawdown, but a complete withdrawal has been on the table with this president because he doesn't like the fact that the United States is spending money. If Kim Jong-un proposes that to him, there is a great fear that he'll accept that, and suddenly all U.S. troops will be pulled out of Korea and leave our allies on the hook without any other, without really thinking about their security at the same time.
That's Carl Friedhoff, a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Carl, thanks for giving us a little bit more context ahead of this historic summit. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Tammy Duckworth this morning just released a statement also about the summit and said, quote, if and when he sits down with one of the world's most inhumane dictators, I urge the president to remain clear-eyed about North Korea's long history of violating previous denuclearization promises. He must not sell out our South Korean and Japanese allies or undermine our own national security interests in search of a dramatic television moment consisting of more style and substance. Details matter here. And when it comes to Kim Jong-un, can very well be the difference between life and death for millions of human souls in the region. That's Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. Illinois is also home to at least 60,000 Korean Americans. So we thought we'd check in with some folks in Illinois who are watching this very closely. As Carl was explaining the military history, there's lots of families here who know that firsthand. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you're Korean-American or have ties to the region. You can also give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Right now, I want to introduce Albert Lee. He's in studio with me here in Urbana. He's a Korean-American living in Champaign. On the line with us from Chicago is Reverend Nayoung Ha. And on the line from Palatine is Sik Soon. All of you, thank you for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Good morning. Albert, I wonder if we could start. We just heard the policy side of this, but for tens of thousands, millions of people, this is a very personal story and your family's story. I wonder what your family's history is in terms of your family's relationship with North Korea and if you still have family there.
Sure. When people ask me, what is your ethnicity? Where are you from? I say I'm Korean, and they follow up with North or South. And that's actually a very complicated question for me to answer because actually my father's family is from North Korea and I'm a descendant of a North Korean refugee family. So back in during the Korean War in December of 1950, there was a big evacuation of refugees from Port Hungnam. And my father's family was one of those that was on those military vessels that went to the Busan area of South Korea. And so we in that process, my grandmother had three boys. And she had to make the painful decision of which two boys to take with her. And so she ultimately decided on the eldest child and then my father, who was only 1 year old at the time. So she had to leave behind a three-year-old toddler with her mother-in-law. And then her father-in-law accompanied her, but then her father-in-law never saw his wife again until he passed away. And also my grandmother never saw or heard about the what happened to her middle child that she left behind. And she passed away recently.
Mm. Wow. So knowing that, I wonder, how do you look at everything that's happening now?
It's such a, of course, the nuclear issue is a big issue that needs to be resolved. And I think Trump needs to really have his full game on when he meets Kim Jong-un. The North Korean, North Koreans are very savvy in dealing with major powers and negotiating, doing this push-pull, bluffing and all that. But on the personal level, I'd like to see some kind of agreement where there can be some kind of normalization of relations so that these families can get in touch with each other. And those who are still alive, who remember or who have been part of that conflict many years ago, can find out what happened to their family members and have some closure.
That's Albert Lee. We're talking to different Korean Americans across Illinois. I want to go to Reverend Nayoung Ha in Chicago. Reverend Ha, you grew up in South Korea. What did you hear about North Korea when you were growing up?
Yeah, so I was born in 1974, and I grew up mostly under the military dictatorships. And I remember that, you know, in our school, in elementary school, we had always, like, annual writing contest or drawing contest to show our, like, you know, win over or win against North Koreans, especially Gomis. So When I grew up, we always write about how we will fight and then defeat against North Korea. And I remember watching the animation from the TV, and in a TV animation, North Korean faces were not human faces, were old animals, like wolves and foxes, and the leader of North Korea was a pig, huge pig. So when I remember, you know, when I grew up, North Koreans were not one of my family members or some human beings was total enemy. It was remembered that way when I grew up.
Mm. And then I imagine it's such a different picture now living in the U.S.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I was in college, I really studied history, recent modern Korean history through and through. And I realized that, wow, this is totally different story that I've never heard of from under, you know, military dictatorships. So that's the point that I found out the real human faces and our family faces from North Korea, and then relationship between North Korea and South Korea, and, you know, bigger picture with the whole powerful countries in the whole world.
Sik, you also grew up in South Korea. I wonder how people back home for you are reacting to all of this news.
Yes. I think, a lot of people in South Korea is really helpful. I went through the process Reverend Ha just mentioned. So, when I was in high school, I also learned, they depicted North Korea as evil or monster. But same, during 1980s, I went to college. That's when I totally, began to learn, new story of, South and North Korea. So my generation who went to college during 1980s began to start a campaign, let's know about North Korea. So that was a huge campaign in 1980s in colleges under military dictatorship. So a lot of students begin to read about North Korea. Even they send their representative to North Korea. So my generation right now, who fought for reunification under military dictatorship, they are very hopeful right now. They want to get something out of this summit.
And how are you hopeful? What would you like to see come out of this summit, Sik?
I think that this is the beginning. A lot of people are talking about, North Korea has been, breaking the deal they made. I understand that part. But I think that a lot of media also didn't point out that it was also the U.S. who also broke the deal with North Korea. Under Clinton administration, they promised to provide certain aid to North Korea, but they also didn't. So I think that, in a fair sense, you have to point out that in both North Korea and the U.S. Didn't, stick to their promises. So right now, I think it's the beginning of, building a new trust. Without trust, I don't think they can make anything out of it. So this is the process to build that kind of process. And I don't think we can make a, short-term deal. It's going to take a while. But it's a good start. I think that we can make, something out of it to begin that process. I think it would be considered as a success.
We just have about a minute before we take a break here, but Reverend Ha, I just wanted to ask you about the human rights aspect of this. What you would like to see, would you like to see President Trump raise that with Kim Jong-un? What are your concerns on that front?
So my concern in this meeting, I'm really hopeful about this meeting and optimistic. It's just like very rare hopeful news. Since Trump administration got in the U.S. and in a global sense, we mostly heard very painful and sad and, very fearful stories, but this is very hopeful. But my only concern is upon the, unstable and unpredictable Trump's, decision-making or change, sudden changes.
Hmm.
So I really hopeful that, I truly believe that if something good from this meeting is because of the Moon Jae-in, not Trump. And
Reverend Hoff, I can just interrupt you for a second. Sorry, we just have to take a break, but we'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes. If you can just hold that thought for me, stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st, and we'd love to hear from you if you want to give us a call, 1-800-222-9455, as we talk about this historic summit. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We have assembled a panel of Korean Americans here in Illinois, some of the 60,000 or so Korean Americans that live in Illinois, actually. We're hearing their opinions ahead of this historic summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Albert Lee is in studio with me here in Urbana. He's a Korean American living in Champaign. He works actually at the university. He's a lawyer in town. Reverend Nayoung Ha is with us on the line from Chicago. She's an organizing director with the Hana Center. And Sik Sun is on the line from Palatine. He's with KA Voice. Reverend Ha, you have done a lot of work on immigration and advocating for immigrants. Just before the break, it sounded like you were talking a little bit about some of the mixed feelings you had about President Trump being the person to convene this summit.
Yeah, that's true. I'm an organizing director at Hana Center. We do a lot of immigrant rights work, especially around the undocumented population in Asian American community. So it's been so painful and hard with this administration because it's human rights abuses, especially in the undocumented population, is so hard and so harsh. So it's kind of mixed feeling. This kind of historic summit happened through this Trump administration. It's kind of strange feeling. But I think that this is like kind of one of the ironic and historical moment that when we had a military dictator's daughter as a president, we had Obama, and now we have, impeachment successful, and we have people's president Moon Jae-in is in Korea, and now we have Trump administration in U.S. But I really hope that this summit is not played by the politics that usually Trump is doing, but it's led by, people's hope and then wishes and prayers. So that if something good from this meeting, I think it's not because of Trump. It's because of Moon Jae-in. And he's not playing politics. He really geared toward the people's hope and wishes. And so, that's my opinion. And if something, I know this Democratic Party has a mixed feeling about this historical happen done by Trump. And, Trump administration can brag about it. But the reality is that it's not, all about Trump. It should be from people's hope and then wishes. And then I think President Moon Jae-in did a great job.
Mm. Sik, as we wrap up this discussion, I wanted to ask you just one final question. As we're hearing so much about Korea, Korean Americans, and we're seeing this in the news, are there any myths about Korea or Korean Americans that you think is important to dispel?
Oh, I think that, what I'd like to point out is that, sometimes people didn't realize how dangerous the military option is. When you look at the Korean Peninsula, especially the Seoul, the capital city of South Korea, has like a 4 million people. It's 10 million, over 10 million people. It's really crowded, and North Korea has a weapon who can reach in South Korea, in 10 minutes. So if something broken, South Korea, will be demarcated by, artillery in like 15 minutes. That will cause a lot of damages, not only, in terms of population, but also, world economy. So I think that, the thinking of military option makers, chill. It's really, fear that Korean Americans and Koreans have. So when people think about that kind of option, they have to understand, you know, what kind of situation Korea has. Also, the other thing I would like to point is that the North Korea, they went through a Korean War. At the time, North Korea was bombarded by U.S. airplane. As a result, right now, most of North Korea's military facility went underground. They're very well hidden. And North Korea has very mountainous areas. So it's really hard to attack North Korea by plane. Mm. So I think that when people talk about military option, I want them to realize how difficult it is in that real situation.
Albert, what do you want folks to know as they're thinking about this? Certainly, SICK has given us a real sense of what's at stake here and how many millions of lives are involved.
I would like to just reiterate, what he just said. The military option is just completely unthinkable from the Korean perspective. Whether you're Korean or Korean-American, there are almost 2 million Korean-Americans in America, and we're very diverse in our views, very diverse in our backgrounds, diverse in our political outlooks. But I think we are all would think that for war to break out again, especially with nuclear weapons in play, that's like having Washington, D.C. and New York all being obliterated at the same time in one fell swoop, and it's just unthinkable.
That's Albert Lee. I want to thank Reverend Nayoung Ha and SICK Sun as well for being with me as we pay attention to what will convene this evening, our time, Tuesday morning in Singapore, this historic summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Rock River Trail stretches through 11 counties in both Wisconsin and Illinois, although a handful of Illinoisans have completed this trail by foot, car, or paddle. Two Northern Illinois natives are hoping to become the first to complete the 320-mile Rock River Trail by bike. Carl Nelson is a host and producer at WNIJ. Dan Liedman is a writer and English instructor at Northern Illinois University. The pair set out yesterday at the intersection of Rock River and the Mississippi in Wisconsin, and they're working their way down as part of the five-day trek. And they're on the line with me now from southern Wisconsin. Carl, Dan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So where exactly are you guys? Carl, can you tell me where you are?
We're in Fort Atkinson right now. We just saw a couple sites, a poetry wall downtown. And Dan, you want to tell us where we're headed?
We're heading to see the poetry house of the poet Niedeker. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but we're going to learn about her when we get to the house where she lived. And we have a professor from Beloit College who's going to kind of give us a little bit of a tour, Professor Chris Fink. So we're learning a lot about the cultural history of a lot of stuff on the river as well as riding on it.
All right. So you guys are going 320 miles along this trail. Carl, do you want to just give us a sense? We've got people listening all across the state. If you can give us just a geography lesson of where you're going exactly.
Sure. So we started yesterday morning in Theresa. We assumed it was pronounced Teresa. We were wrong about that. Schooled by the locals there. So that's just south of Lake Oshkosh. And then we passed through Horicon, where they have Horicon Marsh there. It's the largest freshwater cattail marsh in North America. We went snaked around through a few other communities, and we ended up in Watertown, Wisconsin last night. Then this morning we hit the roads. We went through, Johnson Creek, and then now we're in Fort Atkinson, and tonight we'll be in Beloit. We pass through Janesville, and then we'll be on down through Rockford, Oregon, Prophetstown, and out to the Quad Cities.
And, Dan, what's the landscape like?
You know what? It's hillier than we were expecting, but it's beautiful. The first day, it rained on us, but we went through such gorgeous farmland, and we saw a lot of blue herons and snowy egrets and stuff. We saw a lot of wonderful birds. And now it's starting to flatten out as we go further south. But, the landscape's been gorgeous. And, of course, we're just along the Rock River the whole time.
And what are your goals for how many? So you're trying to do this over 5 days. How many miles are you trying to do a day, Dan?
Today's going to be the longest day. We're going to do 80 miles. We're going to end up in Beloit. After that, they're basically 60 to 70 mile days.
80 miles. Carl, how did you train for that?
Well, Dan is much more of an avid cyclist than I am. I bike around town, but I did some. I tried to do
not 70 miles a day, Carl.
No. So this has been quite the physical education course here for me.
Dan, how do you train? Did you train for this, Dan?
Well, I trained for yes. I mean, I trained because I've just done a lot of rides. We're doing self-sustained riding, which is a little different from road riding. We're carrying our bags and we're carrying tents and all of our clothes and stuff. So some of the challenge has to do with going uphill with all that weight on your bicycle.
Are you guys worried about getting this done? It sounds like you sound pretty optimistic about it. I'm talking to you on day one, so I hope you're optimistic at this point, right?
Yeah, actually day two.
Oh, day two, right.
Go ahead. Well, yeah. Go ahead, Carl.
Oh, I was going to say, I like to remain foolishly naive that we are going to make it.
Yeah, he's great. Every time I feel bad, like about the weather or something, he says, "Oh, we'll be fine." And then I think, yeah, he's right. We'll be fine.
How did you guys come up with this idea, Dan?
Actually, it was the staff at WNIJ, which is the DeKalb NPR affiliate. It was their idea. Dan Klefstad contacted me, and I had done other rides for them in the past. I rode on Lincoln Highway in the WNIJ listening area. So I reported on from Ragbri for them, that sort of thing. But yeah, it was their idea.
And Carl, is that how you got? That's how you got involved with this?
Yeah, I'm always game for a harebrained idea. So when it was suggested, I of course popped right on board.
Carl, Dan mentioned meeting up with somebody in Beloit later today. Who have you guys met so far?
Dan, you want to handle that?
Oh, you know, we've met like wonderful people. We started out meeting the president of the village of the Riza in Wisconsin. And today we're meeting with Chris Fink, who's he's actually here with us now. He's a professor at Beloit College, who's a literature professor. And he's kind of given us sort of schooling us on the poetry and the art of the area. And actually yesterday, my favorite person that we met was a bartender at Carl. What was the name of that bar?
Danny Boy's.
No, it's not Danny Boy's.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Firecracker.
Yeah. We learned all about this dice game that they play in bars in Wisconsin. Yeah, we're just meeting a ton of people.
Ah, so we actually have a little bit of audio of your dice game that we got thanks to thanks to the wonderful folks at WNIJ. Let's hear some of that.
All right, so shake of the day varies everywhere you go. And he was close. He got 3 sixes. If he would have got 4, he would have got a free drink. 5 would have gotten $20.
Really?
6, half the pot. I don't know what the pot is.
This is the second bar we've been in. The second time I've seen people doing this. So I asked you what was going on with the dice, and your answer was, "You're not from Wisconsin."
You're not from Wisconsin, right?
Carl, is that what this is? So did you learn, Carl, you learned a new Wisconsin dice game?
Yeah, you know, we just saw people doing that earlier, and we were like, "What the heck is this?" They seem to be really into this, and so we eventually had to ask about it.
Or what other? What are you guys most looking forward to, Dan, on this ride? Because you're doing, as you said, both journalistic and historical things. You're checking in with folks. Dan, what are you most excited about seeing over the next week?
You know, the best thing about doing it on a bicycle as opposed to doing it by car is that you really can't plan what's going to happen. You have no idea. The weather could slow you down. The wind can slow you down. You get a flat tire, that's going to maybe be half the afternoon. So there's really no telling. I'm looking forward to talking. We're going to meet some people in Rockford and talk about what the Rock River has meant to them. And I think we're supposed to meet with the mayor of Rockford. I'm kind of looking forward to that. And then when we go down to Oregon, we're supposed to be able to see the art colony, the Eagle's Nest art colony. We're going to see some of the paintings there. We're going to get a tour of that. So, yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of stuff on the agenda, and hopefully we'll be able to do it. You never can tell on a bike, though.
Well, best wishes to you all. Carl Nelson is a host and producer at our partner station, WNIJ. Dan Liebman is a writer and English instructor at NIU. If you're interested in following Carl and Dan on their journey as they're biking this Rock River Valley Trail, their travel diary is going to be posted on WNIJ.org and shared on Facebook. And if you follow us on Twitter at 21STShow, we'll have more information there as well. Safe, happy biking, guys. I hope it goes well.
Thank you. Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the 21st, I hope the weather's going to be good for these guys. We're going to be talking about yesterday's storms in Champaign. We know National Weather Service investigators are on the scene today to determine whether or not a tornado actually touched down. Regardless, we thought this was a good time to talk tornado safety and make sure you and your loved ones have a plan in place. Tune in tomorrow for that. Do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily find past shows that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on how to contact us. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a good day.